You can listen to The Professional Left wherever you get your podcasts, on Netroots Radio, or at our website, proleftpod.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for May 19th, 2026. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from the Cornfield Resistance, where we're still in countdown mode.
4, 5, 7, 6, 8, 9, 9, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6.
Because this is the 993rd episode of the Professional Left Podcast with Drift Class and Blue Gal.
In case you didn't recognize it, either because you don't remember it or didn't study it in American political history class.
Yeah, thanks for making me feel old, Blue Gal. Yeah.
Well, I mean, come on. There's a lot of people who...
Yeah, never heard of it.
We're born 50 years after this happened.
Exactly.
We're adults.
Several of whom have graduated from college recently, so...
Yeah. Drift Class and I now have all of our children as college graduates as of this past weekend.
Yes.
Which is a milestone. It really is.
It really is.
But, you know, this countdown thing, that was from the Notorious Daisy ad. Mm-hmm. Notice they didn't say controversial, Driftless.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah. This Daisy ad, which aired on television as part of Lyndon B. Johnson's 1964 presidential campaign, though it aired only once, it is considered one of the most important factors in Johnson's landslide victory over the Republican Party's candidate, Barry Goldwater, and a turning point in political and advertising history. And I do want to say, Johnson understood before it existed the power of going viral.
Yes, he did.
This only ran once, but everybody was talking about it. And so the news had to show it.
Yeah, and they did. And boy, and they did. Because in your heart, you know he's right, Blue Gal, but in your guts...
You know he's nuts.
You know he's nuts. And, you know, this is not the first, but this was an example of a Democrat willing to play fucking hardball, because playing hardball would get the job done.
And to point out to everybody that Barry Goldwater was so fiercely anti-communist that he was willing to use a nuke.
Yeah. Yeah. Which,
you know, that's not okay.
Which scared people back then. Now, according to LBJ's press secretary, Bill Moyers, the White House switchboard lit up with calls protesting the ad.
Excellent.
Johnson called him and asked, Jesus Christ, what in the world happened? According to Wikipedia, though initially surprised by the protest, Johnson was later very pleased with the ad and wanted it to be broadcast again. But Moyers convinced him this is so smart that it was a poor idea. Moyers later said that the ad accomplished its purpose in one showing. To repeat it would have been pointless. It's the punch Ali never had to throw.
Yeah. No. And there was no YouTube.
No. Oh, no. No.
Kids can't believe that when we started blogging and podcasting, there was no new YouTube.
There was no YouTube
at all.
You know what YouTube was? It was Crooks and Liars.
Yeah. Right. John Amato found the way to post video before YouTube. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
And that's why we're all millionaires, Blue Gal.
No. That didn't turn out to be the case.
No.
A couple of episodes ago, we said we were going to talk about the pivotal year 2008, how we got there, what happened, and what it led to. Well, you know, Drift Class, you put a quarter in him and he wants to talk an hour about 2007. So it took us a couple of episodes to get a running start, but here we are at last. So let's do a quick recap for anyone who's coming in mid-story. In January of 2008, the talk on the Sunday shows was not about the cratering economy or the deficit or Iraq. It was, surprisingly, Republicans in disarray.
Yeah, how can this be? And are Democrats going to blow it? Now, as everyone on TV was too polite to mention, the subgroups that formed the Reagan coalition had absolutely nothing in common with each other past some deluded idea that Hulk smash government will bring about some new golden age or gilded age or rapture, or the Confederacy will rise again or something. and the adhesive force that had kept all the subcultures working together to destroy America had been hatred. Blind, terrified, deliberately induced, and cultivated hatred, which works only as long as they're capable of keeping from mutually annihilating each other and keeping their pinhead berserker fury directed at the usual suspects. You know, poor people, minorities, the rest of the planet, people who read and think for themselves, uppity women, gays, imaginary flag burners, can't leave those people out, imaginary dirty fucking hippies, and of course, everybody else, all the usual suspects.
And the one person the pundits and Republicans both agreed might be able to save Republicans from themselves was Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. They were 8 years too soon, but they were onto something. Republicans' reserves of hatred for the Clintons was still strong enough that many on the right absolutely saw her as their philosopher's stone. Someone who could convert the raw moral sewage of the base's hatred into electoral gold one last time.
Yeah.
They would forget their differences and turn their ire and fire to Hillary.
Yeah. Building, you know, creating a hate machine pays big dividends in the short term. In the long term, you get Donald Trump. So, but you got to ask yourself, you know, this is what we were asking back then. A lot of people were, surely after Iraq and Katrina and deficits and corruption and the financial collapse, voters weren't going to go back to this failed party and their failed ideology anytime soon, right? That couldn't possibly happen. The failure of the Bush regime and all the Bush cheerleaders and hype men was so public and comprehensive that by October of 2006, mind you, 2006, 2 years before the 2008 elections, a month before the 2006 midterms, the New Yorker magazine was asking this musical question, Blue Gal.
This musical question that I found on my blog.
Yeah.
From 2008.
Because my baby's got archives.
I've got archives. And this puff piece in the New Yorker is a trip.
You're not going to find this on any other podcast this week.
No,
I can
not.
Guarantee you that.
We guarantee you this. This is New Yorker magazine in 2006. Quote, Murdoch's game. Will he move left in 2008? I can't.
I know.
The success of Fox News Channel, which Murdoch launched in 1996, has secured his reputation as a strident conservative. So it came as a shock to both his right-wing allies and his liberal enemies when he, in July, hosted a fundraising breakfast for Hillary Rodham Clinton. During the Clinton administration, both the Post and Fox News pilloried the first couple with a relish bordering on cruelty. Page 6, the Post's famous gossip column, referred to the president, meaning President Clinton, as Horn Dog in Chief, and Sean Delonis, its editorial cartoonist, routinely depicted him in his underpants. How time has passed, Drift Glass.
Well, the quaint good old days, Blue Gal. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know. Since September 11th, Murdoch's media outlets have sometimes seemed like propaganda arms of the Bush administration. You don't say!
Yeah, wow, seemed like. Daring.
Seemed like.
Yeah.
Skewering anybody who dares to question the president's war on terror. Last year, Bill O'Reilly, one of Fox's most popular anchors, suggested that the American Civil Liberties Union and the judges who side with them are terror allies. When the Abu Ghraib prison story broke, the Post, meaning the New York Post, didn't even put it on the front page.
Certainly reminds me of now, Blue Gal.
Yeah, a lot. Mm-hmm. The fundraiser for Hillary Clinton took place on July 17th at News Corp's Midtown Tower, which houses the Post and Fox News. Among the News Corp executives who attended the Hillary Clinton fundraiser were Roger Ailes, the veteran Republican operative who runs Fox News, and Cole Allen, the pugnacious Australian-born editor of the Post. Clinton spoke for about 20 minutes and then took questions. The breakfast raised more than $60,000 for Clinton's senatorial reelection campaign. Neither Ailes nor Allen contributed any money. And it led to speculation that Murdoch was preparing to endorse Hillary in the 2008 presidential campaign. appearing on the Charlie Rose Show. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a time capsule.
This is absolutely. On July 20th, Murdoch said that an endorsement was unlikely, which didn't exactly reassure conservatives. In August, they became more agitated after Murdoch played host to Bill Clinton and Al Gore at a News Corp retreat in California. The nature of the event confirms our suspicion that Murdoch may be moving left as the 2008 U.S. presidential election approaches, and that he may bring his conservative, quote unquote, air quotes, news properties with him. Cliff Kincaid, an editor at Accuracy and Media, a conservative watchdog group. Is that what they are? No.
Yeah, more or less. There used to be.
Commented on the organization's website, unquote.
Yeah. So, you know, we have this alternate podcast that we get to every now and then called Science Fiction University, right? This is not science fiction beamed in from some alternate timeline. This was real life 20 years ago because Republicans had so obviously shit the bed so badly that it was beginning to look like Republicans would once again be relegated to the status of permanent minority party as they were during the FDR years. But, of course, to believe this was to profoundly misunderstand the Republican base, who had already been soaking up nonstop, unhinged propaganda and conspiracies from Murdoch's own outlets as well as hate radio for decades. It was already too late to restore most of them to sanity, and they were in no mood to hear about the reason Bush had failed them and betrayed them so badly, betrayed their loyalty, was that liberals had been right about the right all along. They did not want to hear that at all.
Nope.
Just like now, when a whole bunch of our Never Trump allies do not want to hear the left was right, and Republicans do not want to hear it, and the media doesn't want to hear it, even though it's just the facts. The reason Bush had failed them, therefore, had to be because he wasn't conservative enough, Blue Gal. And look for a bunch of Republicans saying that about Trump once Trump is gone.
He wasn't a real conservative or a real conservatism Republican.
True conservatism has never been tried, Blue Gal.
Yeah, right.
So, Bush wasn't cruel enough. He didn't attack the dirty, commie, terrorist-loving left hard enough. That was the reason.
Yeah, and we're going to blame Trump. We're going to blame dead Trump, maybe honor his memory. They're going to attack him for the deficits and say, we can't possibly spend any more than we already have. We've got to cut everything now,
right,
including Medicare and Social Security, because fiscal responsibility. We need to get back to our roots in the Republican party. That's coming.
Yeah, you know,
brace yourselves for that. And because, as I've said before, anyone who opens their pie hole and says that gets to eat a bag of dog shit.
Yeah. Well, and the reason we're pretty sure about this is we have archives. We have been to this movie.
Yes. This is it. They're all complicit with how Trump came to power. All of them.
And it's all, this is like they say on Battlestar Galactica, all this has happened before. All of this will happen again. This is just how Republicans are. This isn't just Trump. This is how the Republican Party is and has been at escalating levels for as long as you've been alive. And that's what our archive.
Because this is the Confederacy.
Yeah.
We weren't wrong. This was the honored, what did they call it? The great cause?
Yeah.
Noble cause? Yeah.
The lost cause.
Yeah. Okay. The base wasn't looking for someone who would make accommodations to the Democrats, who would go hat in hand to ask them pretty please to be included at the adult table. They had tasted real power and wall-to-wall control of the federal government, and they liked it. So they went looking for solutions from Ann Coulter and Michael Savage, not the Concord Coalition or the Peterson Foundation. You might remember that Mitt Romney tried to capitalize on this idiotic excuse by telling voters in 2012 that he was not just conservative, but severely conservative.
And I fought against long odds in a deep blue state, but I was a severely conservative Republican governor.
And you might also remember that Barack Obama had some fun with Romney's, evolving opinion of his own conservatism.
Now, Governor Romney has been pitching this plan for almost a year now. He stood up on the stage in one of his primary debates, proudly promised that his new tax cuts on top of the Bush tax cuts would include the top 1%. Now, you wouldn't know this from listening to the new latest version of Mitt Romney. He's trying to go through an extreme makeover. After running for more than a year in which he called himself severely conservative, Mitt Romney is trying to convince you that he was severely kidding.
In fact, to try to keep his footing as the Republican Party rumbled and rolled beneath him, Romney tried to evolve, quote unquote, on a whole lot of issues.
And we'll get back to all of that in a little while, because the groundwork for Romney's doomed 2012 campaign, as well as the rest of our shared history from then until now, was being laid in 2008 and 2009, because that's when the Reagan coalition began to fall apart, leaving Republicans running for office with only two choices: try to straddle all the factions and differences, or pick a side and go all in. There is an old Klingon proverb which says,
"Only a fool fights in a burning house."
Tragically, with the U.S. stuck in endless wars that we've been lied into, an economy in free fall, and a healthcare system that was disastrous and getting worse, Republicans chose to become exactly the sort of fools who would fight in a burning house. For them, the first priority was not to help the incoming president stop the economy from hemorrhaging jobs and destroying lives. Their first and only priority was to sabotage Barack Obama as quickly and as ruthlessly as possible.
This is from Vanity Fair, April 27th, 2012. Quote, "The conspiracy to commit legislative constipation." In a scene reminiscent of the summit meeting of mob bosses in The Godfather, Republican House leaders were summoned by evil marshmallow and message crafter Frank Luntz to hash out a strategy to cope with the defeat of their party in 2008 and the election of the newly inaugurated President Obama. According to Robert Draper's just-published book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, from a report on Draper's revelation by Ewan McCaskill in The Guardian UK, during a lengthy discussion, the senior GOP members worked out a plan to repeatedly block Obama over the coming 4 years to try to ensure he would not be reelected, unquote.
And by the way, that article is by James Walcott, whose writing I miss very much. He doesn't do that sort of thing anymore. And for the record, while Republican leadership was dining on overpriced steak and figuring out how to best make a bad situation exponentially worse and then blame Obama for it, this is what each of us were doing at the time.
Well, in 2008, I was getting a divorce and moving my three children, who were 4 to 7, to Springfield, Illinois. And we went on Medicaid, and we eventually went on food stamps, and found a church. Actually, in May of 2008, I went to a meeting at a church in Springfield. I was visiting, getting my house purchased and so forth. And I went to a meeting at a church in town that was advertised as a interdenominational peace meeting, commemorating the 5th anniversary of the war in Iraq, which was supposed to be over by Christmas.
Yep.
And I went to this fairly large church, knowing that this wasn't a service. This wasn't a church service. This was an actual meeting, but it was organized by the pastor of this United Methodist Church in Springfield. And there were nuns, and there were rabbis, and there were Muslim leaders, and there were Black church leaders, and basically, you know, the entire gamut of religious leaders in Springfield attended and spoke about peace and against the war, because they're talking about peace.
Right.
And it was so meaningful to me that someone, a leader in the community, in terms of, you know, being the pastor of this obviously somewhat large church that had three services on Sunday, which I'd never attended a church that had three services on Sunday. That's a big church for me. Gave a damn.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was walking out, there were all these pamphlets, and one of the pamphlets was about Sunday school programs. And I'm like, okay,
yeah.
I just need an hour without these kids. I'm going to take them to this church. And I joined this church.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still a member of that church. And that my appreciation for that church and their stand on their stand and lack of a stand on political situations has ebbed and flowed over the years.
Well, and just compare and contrast, maybe. Yeah. As I recall, I wasn't down here then. You and I were not involved then.
Right.
You were busy, you know, raising kids and getting a divorce and all the things. But we knew each other. And
we did.
And that church, I'm now a member of that church because you sucked me in, Blue Gal. You just sucked me into that church. But nobody quit the church because there was a pro-peace meeting on church property.
Right, right.
Nobody stomped out and said, I'm not putting up with this crap.
Right.
And took their checkbook and left. Mm-hmm. You jump ahead a few years to the Trump administration.
To the past 12 months. Right?
Any whisper, the most anodyne sign you could imagine about love versus hate, people have quit the church.
Love unite, hate divides, love unites. That's the sign.
They left.
And
they left.
People quit the church over that.
Yeah.
Trumpers quit the church.
That's how that, and this is why, really, if you want to know how Republicans are out here in the real world and what direction they're headed in, don't.
Saying that love unites people is a political statement, and how dare you?
How dare you? It's insulting, and it's attacking
and I think
me.
They felt ganged up upon because events were turning so quickly.
Right.
That, you know, all of a sudden, ICE arresting people.
Right.
Who have green cards or children, putting children in custody. Indefensible.
Right.
So they stopped defending it and left.
Especially if you're talking about the New Testament and the teachings of the guy after whom the church is supposed to be named.
Yeah.
And, you know, helping the stranger and the immigrant and the poor, all of which they consider to be radical liberal heresy.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And and so seriously, if you want to know what Republicans are doing, ask somebody who lives in central Illinois, who's a liberal, who's looking at them from the outside, but are neighbors with them. That's we can give you the straight dope. And we always have. Now, I was in a different situation. I was in Chicago at the time at Castle Drift Glass. You might remember the castle.
Yes, the castle. Drift Glass.
And I was about
a lone wolf.
It was a lone wolf. I was divorced. I had a big old condo I was rattling around in. And I found out in 2008 that I was losing my job, not due to incompetence or lack of, I just gotten a bonus, as a matter of fact, for being a really, really effective project manager and project leader, but they needed someone in my salary range to go away because other departments were actually starting to have to do mass layoffs. And there are certain people you cannot lay off at the city of Chicago without.
But they're related to the mayor or something like that.
There are favors, dude. This is how clout works. So there would have been repercussions. So they needed a soft place for other people to land. And I was a technocrat, not a political appointee. So out I went. And in the course of, you know, very short order, I lost my job. I lost my career, really, because nobody wants to hire a workforce development guy specializing in manufacturing. During a global collapse of the economy that is being led by the manufacturing sector.
And who's over 45?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's the other part of it.
I found out real quick that I had aged out of the workforce by the age of 45. I was unemployable. And I'm unemployable in Springfield for very much the same reason. So I lost my condo. I lost my career. I lost my savings. I lost my health care. And on and on and on. It was, you know, and I think I said our last episode, but I gained net a beautiful wife, a wonderful family, and a happy home in Springfield. So I'm the winner. I'm the big winner of the Great Recession.
And I remember the question that you asked me in 2008, because we were talking a lot about blogging versus jobs versus, you and I did talk a lot during that year. And then we had 2 years later, we started a podcast because we were talking all the time. By that time, we're talking all the time.
Just get a goddamn microphone and make it a podcast.
Exactly. And we were meeting at Chicago meetups and people would stop talking and listen to the two of us talk and say, you guys need to get a radio show or something.
For God's sakes.
We had a good rapport and both of us had a depth of historical knowledge and could carry on a conversation for an hour. Anyway, but I remember you asking me, maybe I should give up writing about David Brooks.
Yeah.
For my career, so that I can have a career again.
Yeah.
You know, because it may be that someone got word of this and now I'm on a do not hire list because of politics.
Yeah.
My politics.
Very well could have been.
And I said, oh, hell no. And I think at that point you realized, she's quality. She's somebody that has my back.
Yeah, she's on my side. She's on my
side. I'm on your side. Yeah. I think you and I you and I fell in love gradually over time. But
yeah. Thank you, Internet.
That was one of those crystallizing moments when you saw a woman who had your back.
Yeah. And I think even my dumb decisions, you're willing to back for a certain period of time, which I do appreciate. I've never mentioned this before, but the whole idea that of the long suffering risk taking that never Trumpers have gone through, because they lost friends when they left the Nazi party, and they lost a lot of lucrative jobs, and now they have to make do with book contracts and having a giant website supported by a cable news. Mm-hmm.
Being a regular contributor at MS Now.
Yeah, they have to, they took a pay cut.
Yeah.
Let me explain. I was podcasting on the job, not while at my desk, but on the job while I was working as a fairly highly placed executive.
You weren't podcasting. You were blogging.
Blogging.
Yeah.
Exactly. At the city of Chicago. Yeah. I would skip out to the hippie joint down the block because that's the only place that had reliable internet. And I'd get a little lunch and I'd do some blogging. I'd go home. If there was a function after work, I would leave. I would do Irish leave. And where's Drift Class? He's gone. We don't know where he went. And go home and do blogging. But I was, at all those time, never more than one or two phone calls away from being fired.
Yeah.
Because if anyone had found out that an executive at the city of Chicago was saying these terrible, terrible things about the Bush administration and these not very nice things about the Daley administration, I would have been fired that day. So my job was always, always at risk.
Yeah.
If anybody found out who I was.
Which is why you were anonymous at that point.
Yeah, I had to be. And every 6 months, believe it or not, I had to sign an ethics agreement explaining every place I ever got money from.
Yeah.
Which
and
is
that's
why I never,
you didn't fundraise at your blog.
So I never did a fundraiser.
Yeah.
I explained that I had a salary from Columbia College for teaching three classes a semester, which is why I was tired all the time. But I was divorced and I had to pay for a condo. But I lost everything.
Yeah.
And I had to be anonymous, or I would have lost my income. It turns out I did. But in the end, since I was a workforce development specialist and knew, I mean, I was one of the design team on the state of Illinois workforce development site.
Yeah.
I knew everybody involved and I knew all the statistics. And I knew what was happening, but sort of in a way that other people did not. And I knew that I was in possession of cursed knowledge.
Yeah, right.
I know exactly how bad this is going to get. And I know that it's going to be so very much worse than anyone imagines in 2008. All the workforce development people were seeing these gigantic layoffs and factories shutting down. And it was only going to get worse. So that's what you and I were up to in 2008.
Let's get back to Republican sabotage.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
So Republican sabotage, trying to set fire to the gas tank and saw off the landing gear as Barack Obama tried to bring the crippled global economy in for a safe landing, which began in earnest with something called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, the ARRA. Obama's stimulus bill was passed during the Great Recession. Obama's original ask, which he proposed during the transition period in late 2008, was generally understood inside the administration to be between $1.2 trillion and $1.8 trillion, depending on which estimates you use and what got counted. The final enacted American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 package was half or less than that, about $787 billion initially.
Now, Obama's economic advisors, like Christina Romer, believe that the collapsing economy required a stimulus much larger than what eventually passed. And Romer and Jared Bernstein reportedly modeled options reaching roughly $1.2 trillion to $1.8 trillion to close the output gap and stop unemployment from spiraling. But guess what? Political advisors like Larry Summers and a few congressional Democrats told him that Congress would never pass something that large in early 2009. So the original ask was cut in half, and pretty much all the reductions between what was needed and what Obama got were the result of concessions Democrats made to try to get Republican votes.
Remember that. That's the goal. Mm-hmm. Get Republican votes for the Recovery Act.
To save the country. to stop the worst economic catastrophe, or at least mitigate in 75 years that Bush just ignored until it was way too late.
He froze. Mm-hmm. And McCain didn't do much better. He kept, suspending his campaign to deal with the crisis. And then there was nothing to do because he wasn't president. Anyway, the key compromises that Democrats made were, first, surprise, much larger tax cuts than many Democrats wanted. To attract moderate Republicans and get them to vote for the bill, the package shifted heavily toward tax relief. Originally, many Democrats preferred the more direct infrastructure spending, more aid to states, and more public works employment. Instead, about one-third of the package became tax cuts. These included business tax incentives and accelerated depreciation write-offs. This was done specifically to appeal to GOP demands for tax relief, tax relief, rather than what they considered pure government spending.
Yeah. And by the way, this is why this episode is called "An Only Fools Fight in a Burning House." The house was burning down and Republicans were just fucking around and trying to, number one priority was hurt Obama, not save the country. Second, a reduction in the overall size. History showed, and a number of economists predicted, that the recession required a substantially larger stimulus. But it was cut way down to accommodate the GOP suddenly getting interested in deficits again. Aw, that's adorable. And to hold together moderate senators.
What happened to the surplus again, Driftglass?
Oh, we're going to have surpluses forever, Blue Gal. Everyone
knows that's right.
That.
And the tax cut should have been bigger.
Should have been bigger.
Third, one of the biggest compromises came during Senate negotiations with moderate Republicans like Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, and Arlen Specter. To get their votes, Democrats moved or reduced school modernization funds, a lot of infrastructure spending, and certain state stabilization funds. About $100 billion in spending was cut during these negotiations with the Senate.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add that one of the things the ARRA did that the Enron disaster couldn't do was extend unemployment benefits for people, because this thing ran for years.
Yeah.
And unemployment benefits run out real fast, mm-hmm. especially when there's no jobs to be found. And so it doesn't really matter how hard you look.
Applying everywhere and there isn't anything to apply to. Yeah.
And that's what states were begging for. Mm-hmm. Was please give us enough money to keep people at least on unemployment and at least on SNAP until this thing is over, because we got people who are just falling off by the thousands. Mm-hmm. So fourth, Republicans criticized spending as too long-term, too, socialist-y, and too green energy focused. Wow, does that sound familiar? Yeah. So the final bill leaned more towards immediate stimulus and temporary relief rather than permanent structural programs.
Fifth, much smaller state fiscal relief than many governors requested, even red state governors.
Yep.
States were bleeding money and jobs during the recession. Many Democrats wanted much larger Medicaid stabilization aid and direct state assistance. Republicans hated that, so more cuts. And while the resulting aid did help prevent layoffs, it was insufficient to meet the crisis. While Obama was desperately trying to placate Republicans who were out to destroy him, this is how Republicans were framing the issue.
At CPAC in February of 2009, John Boehner attacked Obama's stimulus budget as, quote, one big down payment on a new American socialist experiment, unquote. This, by the way, was one of the earliest major attempts to mainstream the idea that Obama-era Democratic governance, this is 2009, February 2009, this is a month after Obama's been sworn in, mm-hmm. was fundamentally alien or un-American rather than merely liberal. Boehner also repeatedly characterized the stimulus as a spending binge, a government takeover, and theft from our kids and our grandkids. Now, it's important to note, this rhetoric became foundational to the later fake Tea Party messaging. So remember it, because we're going to come to it in a little bit.
From the Washington Post, July 27th, 2009, quote, South Carolina senator is a voice of reform opposition. DeMint, a champion of conservatives. Last week, Senator Jim DeMint likened the president's health care fight to Napoleon Bonaparte's final defeat. If we're able to stop Obama on this, it will be his Waterloo. He said in a conference call with GOP activists, it will break him, unquote. That quote became infamous because the economy was in free fall. Unemployment was surging, and that meant people were losing their health insurance by the thousands every day. And DeMint openly framed defeating the stimulus primarily as a way to politically cripple a newly elected president. The comment was widely interpreted as signaling a strategy of maximal obstruction from the start of the Obama presidency, which we now know was exactly the plan.
Yep. And Mike Pence of Hang Mike Pence fame denounced it as, quote, a spending bill masquerading as a stimulus bill, unquote.
He should take a bite out of my ass is what he should do.
Yes, he should.
Rush Limbaugh said very bluntly and publicly that he wanted Obama to fail.
Yeah. And across the board, Republicans framed it using their giant media infrastructure, framed it as socialism, national decline, illegitimate government expansion, or a deliberate attempt to transform America permanently.
You mean like into something that wouldn't have like a deep recession that was causing people to lose all hope?
No, a socialist hellhole
socialist
run by
hellhole.
Barack
by
Obama,
black
the dictator,
yes,
the black
right.
dictator from Kenya.
Yeah. Despite all these concessions and all the Republican foot dragging, the ARRA, this kills me, and also is utterly predictable, it received zero Republican votes in the House. There was no point in negotiating bills with Republicans.
No. There still isn't.
You have the votes or you don't in your caucus. It only got three Republican votes in the Senate. This became a major source of frustration among Democrats who felt Obama had watered down the bill in pursuit of bipartisanship that largely never materialized.
And never
we know
will.
That this was repeated with Obamacare.
Oh, yeah. And this is Republicans. This should have been the moment when everybody, even Republicans of good faith, all nine of them, realized what their party was really about.
Yeah.
And they just refused to see it. They were down with it. They were okay with it because, you know, killing Democrats' chances of reelection and cutting their legs out from under Obama was their only priority. Mm-hmm. And this is what doomed Romney, believe it or not, trying to placate all sides as the Republican Party rumbled and split into pieces beneath him. For example, as the governor of Massachusetts, one of Romney's greatest sources of pride, was passing Romneycare. This is per WGBH in Boston. Quote, Mitt Romney's official gubernatorial portrait unveiled in the Massachusetts State House following his failed 2008 presidential bid, he ran in 2008 too, depicts him casually perched on a desk next to two objects, a photo of his beloved wife, Anne, and a bound copy of the 2006 healthcare reform law that was his crowning policy achievement while in office, unquote.
I was in Boston in 2006.
Yeah, yeah.
When that healthcare reform law passed, at least visiting, and talking to people. And one of the things that it made people do was it made companies insure their employees, regardless of, any of their background or any of their desires or anything. You know, you have to have health insurance for your employees in Massachusetts, period. That's it. And it improves the hospital so much, the hospitals could then plan ahead and know that the people walking into their ER had insurance.
Yeah. And put them on a schedule. You know, put them on a...
Exactly.
Every 6 months, come back. Every 3 months, come back.
Yeah, and we're going to make sure you have your diabetes medication or whatever it is.
And we're going to
catch you much better health outcomes for everybody.
Absolutely. That's,
which we saw with ACA as well.
That's the whole point. Catch it early.
Yeah.
Make them regular members of the healthcare, public.
Yeah.
And it lowers overall costs if, in fact, costs are fairly priced.
Yeah. In his book, No Apology, The Case for American Greatness. That's some word salad right there, Drift Glass. Romney wrote this about Romneycare. Quote, it's portable, affordable health insurance, something people have been talking about for decades. We can accomplish the same thing for everyone in the country, and it can be done without letting government take over health care. Unquote.
Now, that was the original hardcover edition of his book, which was released on March 2nd, 2010. Dates are going to be kind of important now. He hired a ghostwriter named Russell Martin, but he wasn't thrilled with his work. So Romney wrote it himself, and it took him about 6 months. So Romney puts pen to paper in around October of 2009, wraps up and publishes in March of 2010. But here's a really funny thing, Blue Gal, between that happened between the hardcover and the paperback. When the paperback edition of his book came out on February 1st, 2011, it had a few changes to it.
First,
little things, I'm sure, nothing terribly notable. First, a new subtitle. Before, it was No Apology, The Case for American Greatness. Now it was No Apology, Believe in America. Okay, whatever. Now it featured a whole new introduction, which sucked up to the fake Tea Party and really leaned in on the Tea Party slogans about freedom and the U.S. Constitution. He also rewrote the section on the 2009 stimulus to be much more negative about it retrospectively. And most noticeable of all, that Romney Care part about we can accomplish the same thing for everyone in the country had completely vanished, Blue Gal. Gone like a fart in a firestorm. Isn't that weird? Isn't that weird how that just went away for some reason?
That's very weird. What in the world do you suppose happened between October 2009 and February 2011 that would cause Mitt Romney to make these very specific changes to his manifesto? Well, everybody knows what happened.
Yeah.
The Republican Tea Party rebranding scam really took off early in 2009 because, you know, black guy in the White House and Glenn Beck being paid $1 million to promote it.
Yeah.
Large parts of the GOP base rebranded themselves as the Tea Party to duck out of having to explain its unstinting support of the then worst president in modern history for 8 years, and then began an 8-year racist primal scream. There was the Fox News-sponsored National Tax Day protests on April 15th, 2009, because suddenly deficits were bad again. Mm-hmm. But these mouthy jagoffs with their little Gadsden flags were taxed enough already.
Yeah, and this movement organized its first major coordinated action with protests in over 750 cities across the United States, drawing hundreds of thousands of Republicans demonstrating. Well, Republicans. They're just fucking Republicans.
And it was free advertising on Fox. And Hannity spoke at one in Georgia, I think. And
yeah, well,
they tossed out all of their on-air personalities to travel the country and talk about how bad Barack Obama was for America.
And these were a bunch of people on Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah. Taking their scooters.
Taking their Medicare scooters to the public parks to protest the government.
Right.
So, you know, just assholes. They were just assholes. And they were finally felt free to start screaming again because they weren't responsible for Bush. They were a bunch of Tea Partiers. They weren't Republicans. And there were 2009 summer and fall rallies. Activists flooded congressional town hall meetings to scream about, you know, the Affordable Care Act, which led to a massive national demonstration in Washington, D.C. on September 12, 2009. The Affordable Care Act, which was modeled on, drum roll please, modeled on Romney Care.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was a Republican plan.
Yeah.
Because Barack Obama wasn't wedded to anything except accomplishing a few things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was fueling Republican hysteria over the Affordable Care Act? This is from PolitiFact. Quote, the 2009 lie of the year was the claim that the Affordable Care Act would create government death panels. Awarded by PolitiFact, the designation went to former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin for her assertion that fictional government boards would determine whether seniors and people with disabilities were worthy of care.
Mm-hmm.
Palin used the phrase in a social media post, stoking widespread public fear about end-of-life care in the legislation.
Yeah.
Unquote.
He's talking about hospice. He's talking about hospice and talking to your family about end-of-life decisions.
Yeah.
Which is a very important and necessary thing. We both are very familiar with this. And
my parents were on hospice at the end of their lives.
Yeah.
And it improved their care.
Yeah. That's the whole point.
Yep.
But yeah, that's right, kids. It was John McCain's 2008 running mate, Sarah Palin, who coined the term death panels in an August 7th, 2009 Facebook post to attack end-of-life counseling provisions in the early drafts of the ACA and racist Republican-based voters who wanted to believe the scary black man really wanted to murder their sainted white meemaw with it. So now there's this toxic, incredibly awful racist lie spreading through the Republican base like wildfire. So let's see how a responsible adult, the head of the RNC, handled it.
What was his gender and race?
Yeah.
I just gave it away.
Yeah.
From The Atlantic, August 19th, 2009, quote, here via Ben Smith in Politico, is RNC Chairman Michael Steele, like a latter-day Jacques Derrida, deconstructing the question of whether or not death panels exist. Michael Steele said the false death panel rumor about President Obama's health care plan is a grassroots notion that he does not know if he believes.
Who knows?
Steele said he does not regret that Republicans such as Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich raised the death panel issue. Some characterize it as unfortunate. Others characterize it as a reflection of what they think and what they feel. Steele said in an interview on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
Jesus.
Why would boycott MS now?
And now he's back with his own show on MSNBC. Yeah. Yep.
That comes from someplace and is something that's out there. It's Cokie's law.
It's out there.
We have to talk about it because it's out there.
It's out there.
It's about a shit for brains repeating what Sarah Palin said.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's out there in the grassroots of America.
Shit for brains repeating what Sarah Palin said, amplified by a million times by Fox News and hate radio.
And hate radio. And it's not just Republicans saying it. Yeah, yes, it is. Oh, no, Tea Parties are saying it, too.
Country and Western blue gal.
Yeah. Asked if he thinks there was a death panel provision in the bill, a suggestion that has been proven untrue and that the White House has spent a week trying to knock down, Steele said that he does not know. It may or may not be. I don't know. We don't know what the bill is, Steele said. And we're incapable of reading, he should have said. After I stopped slamming my forehead into my desk, it occurred to me that Steele's rhetorical move is really a pretty common one. Just as creationism gave way to intelligent design, the original false claim in this case that the House bill would create death panels has now been replaced by the far more insidious notion that death panels reflect some emotional truth floating around in America. And we'll never really know whether that emotional truth reflects the, you know, factual truth, unquote. I mean, this is we talk about this. When you start pushing back and pushing back and pushing back on a Republican, you will often get both sides.
Right. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a sewing circle or a women's circle or whatever, and this kind of conversation comes up and someone's resisting it, I have heard this multiple times among women. Why can't we have our news and you have your news?
Right. Yes. Yes. That's why Fox News was created. That's why hate news was created.
We just want to have our news, and you can have your news. It's a free country.
That's right.
Like your news is brainwashing the elderly.
Right.
That's why.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who did it, well, I'm not going to say it.
Well, if you want to know who did it, if you want to know the answer to this mystery, just cruise through the last 992 episodes of this podcast, and you'll hear hints of it, you know, cleverly stashed away in there, here and there. So, but
late
just
stage Mussolini drift glass. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, just think about how much that last line about some, you know, emotional truths floating around in America, which was displacing factual truth, prefigures the deranged, racist Republican freakout over the election of Barack Obama in 2008 and the entire Trump era, starting with the other big Republican lies of that era, because there were a bunch of them and they were big. Now that we have a racist lie about the ACA being repeated all over Fox and hate radio, and the leader of the Republican Party just standing aside, letting it happen as if it were some entirely different Republican Party from an entirely different country, no surprise then that the lie of the year in 2010, as reported on December 17th, 2010, by CNN, WBUR, CBS News, NPR, the LA Times, the Cape Cod News, and on was, this is from the New York fucking Times, quote, "And the lie of the year is government takeover of healthcare." PolitiFact, the St. Petersburg Times fact-checking operation, has named that term as its lie of 2010, finding Republicans use the phrase may have been good politics, but it wasn't based on the facts. You know, it's a lie. Government takeover conjures a European approach where the government owns the hospitals and the doctors are public employees, the site wrote, but the law Congress passed, parts of which have already been gone into effect, relies largely on the free market. Yay, free market. The group also said it would not judge the merits of the healthcare overhaul, but did take journalists to task for not consistently challenging the government takeover phrase. This is the second consecutive year that the healthcare debate produced PolitiFact's lie of the year. Last year, death panels took the prize, unquote.
This is what was happening inside the GOP between the time Romney got it into his head to write his political manifesto in 2009 and when he decided to run for president again. And noticed that his manifesto needed some editing.
Yeah.
Suddenly the Tea Party was awesome, and the idea that Romney Care could be applied nationwide was crazy talk. But the tap dancing didn't stop there. You will recall from our last episode what condition the country and the economy was in 2008 under Bush versus where we were under Clinton almost exactly a decade earlier. Specifically, September 30th, 1998, which was the date on which the Clinton administration accomplished something that neither the Reagan administration nor the George H.W. Bush administration ever came close to doing. That was the date the Clinton administration finally eliminated the federal budget deficit entirely, and the U.S. started to run a budget surplus. The Clinton administration continued to run surpluses every year for the rest of his presidency, so that by the year 2000, the federal budget surplus was $237 billion. And by the time he left office in January 2001, the Clinton administration had set the record for the largest total job gain under any U.S. president, overseeing a net increase of approximately 22 to 23 million jobs during his two terms between 1993 and 2001.
Now, a decade later, as the failed Bush administration was limping towards the exit, leaving multiple disasters in its wake, the U.S. economy had already lost 1.624 million jobs and would go on to lose 7 million more, was hurtling towards the worst economic collapse in 75 years. And the U.S. was now running a federal budget deficit of $454.8 billion. And on November 18, 2008, just 2 weeks after Barack Obama had won the election, this was Mitt Romney's advice from his guest op-ed in the New York fucking Times, quote, "Let Detroit go bankrupt," by Mitt Romney. If General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler get the bailout that their chief executives asked for yesterday, you can kiss the American automobile industry goodbye. It won't go overnight, but its demise will be virtually guaranteed. Without the bailout, Detroit will need to drastically restructure itself. With it, the automakers will stay the course. The suicidal course of declining market share, insurmountable labor and retiree benefits, technology atrophy, product inferiority, and never-ending job losses. Detroit needs a turnaround, not a check. Unquote.
Remember, at this moment, the U.S. auto industry and its 1.5 million direct auto industry jobs were hanging by a thread. Mm-hmm. And because the industry has such a huge multiplier effect on the rest of the economy, supply chains, and secondary economic effects, another 2 or 2.5 million jobs were also at risk. Real people who depended on the salaries of those workers being spent on groceries, lawn care, movies, dry cleaning, and so on. Democrats who now controlled the House and the Senate tried to pass the Auto Industry Financing and Restructuring Act, which failed on a nearly party-line vote in the Senate because enough Republicans voted no to prevent cloture and kill the bill.
Yep. What Romney had proposed was a managed bankruptcy in which the auto industry would be radically restructured almost overnight and then would be funded by private capital, which was at best delusional. The Great Recession had killed banks and frozen industrial credit. There was no private capital available to fund Romney's ridiculous scheme. So the Bush White House, who were the people in power at the time, had to use TARP money to prop the industry up, and the Obama administration continued to do so. According to the Department of Treasury, at the end, the U.S. government invested around $80 billion into General Motors and Chrysler and their financing arms through the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. The government successfully recovered roughly $70.4 billion of that principal and interest, leaving the taxpayers with a net direct loss of around $9.3 billion.
And according to Marketplace.org, economists estimated the intervention saved millions of jobs up and down the supply chain. By keeping these companies and dealerships afloat, the government effectively saved or avoided over $100 billion, with a B, in lost taxes and social service expenses that would have spiked due to mass unemployment. Which is why it's no big surprise that just like Romney retconned his views of the Tea Party, Romney Care, and his own conservatism to pander to the base of the Republican Party as he prepared to run for president, through his surrogates, he also began retconning his position on the Detroit auto bailout, because that that op-ed was bad for his campaign.
Well received. Not well received at all.
Right.
This is from The Atlantic, April 12, 2012. Quote, a short history of Mitt Romney's views on the Detroit bailout. Over the weekend, top Romney advisor Eric Fernstrom made an audacious claim. Romney's position on the bailout was exactly what President Obama followed. I know it infuriates them to hear this. The only economic success that President Obama has had is because he followed Mitt Romney's advice. As Fernstrom predicted, yeah, just sit with that for a minute, folks. As Fernstrom predicted, liberals are reacting with irritation and incredulity. They point out, not for the first time, that Romney published a New York Times op-ed in November 2008, even before Obama had taken office, headlined, "Let Detroit Go Bankrupt," unquote.
Politicians trying to tailor their image to suit the audience, and the occasion is as old as time. For example, regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, gender, or orientation, no serious Paul running for office in Chicago is going to skip marching in the St. Patty's Day parade down Columbus Avenue, Columbus Drive, excuse me, the Bud Billiken parade in Bronzeville, or the Pride parade, which runs from just south of Irving Park down to Diversey. But Romney was so clearly uncomfortable with doing what he needed to do to reach out to a base of voters who pretty much loathed everything Romney stood for, but might be willing to swallow it because they hated the scary black man just a little bit more.
Yeah. Which brings us to the third big Republican lie that defined this era. The first was death panels. The second was government takeover of healthcare. Scary black man. And the third was anyone, anyone. It starts with a B. It ends with an ism. And there's an earther in between.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
That's right, birtherism. Trump first picks it up and starts to run with it in 2011 to the delight of the bigots and imbeciles who make up 80%, 90%, 110% of the Republican base.
This is the birther lie timeline via CNN in 2017. And when the host says Trump began showing up on TV, he's not kidding. Trump started floating this racist garbage on The View in March of 2011. After that, the Today Show, Morning Joe, Fox News, Laura Ingraham, and on. And of course, all over hate radio.
The birther movement had its birth in Barack Obama's first presidential run when some Democrats wanted to stop him and hit on this idea that maybe he wasn't born in the United States and wasn't eligible. Hillary Clinton never embraced that story. So why do some people think that she did? Go to 2007 when a campaign aide wrote an assessment of the race where he said Barack Obama's lack of American roots could hold him back in the primary. What he was talking about was Obama's unusual childhood, living some in Hawaii, some in Indonesia, thought that might not play very well with voters. He never said Obama wasn't born in the United States. In fact, we know of one Clinton campaign worker who tried to push that story out, got immediately dumped by the campaign. So what kept the story alive? Republicans embraced it, and Donald Trump in particular. As Donald Trump started considering a run for the presidency himself, here we get to 2011, and suddenly he's showing up on TV saying, why doesn't he, Obama, show his birth certificate? He goes on to talk radio and on the internet saying, I'm starting to wonder myself whether or not he was born in this country. And in an even more pronounced way, he said, if he wasn't born in this country, which is a real possibility, then he's pulled one of the great cons in the story of politics. So you see how he's stacking up the doubt here. And then Barack Obama releases his long-form birth certificate, and everyone thinks the story is dead. It's finished. There's the proof. He was born in America. But not so fast. We move forward, and Trump starts bringing it up again. A lot of people do not think it, that birth certificate, was an authentic certificate. And then he keeps going, saying things on Twitter, for example. He jumps out there and he says, an extremely credible source has called my office and told me that Barack Obama's birth certificate is a fraud. And he keeps building on it. He never lets it entirely die. Every single one of these appearances is from Donald Trump. A lot of people feel it wasn't a proper certificate. And he never stopped with this. It kept coming up, telling CNN just this year, who knows about Obama? Who knows? Who knows? Who cares right now? I have my own theory on Obama. Bottom line, every bit of this came from Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton did not start it, and he did keep it going. Those are two facts, no matter how much Trump may try to deny them.
And this was Trump on the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer in 2013.
And I want everyone to bear with this, because this is 2 minutes of Trump, and I know people hate it when we do this. Listen to how sharp he sounds compared to how he sounds today.
And listen to what he is saying. What motions he is going through.
It's important.
I want to give
Obama
you a chance.
Obama does not like the issue of where he was born. His own publisher, as you know, using his words, said he was born in Kenya and he lived in Indonesia. Of course, now he's denying that amazingly. But I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk, as you said you would, jobs, China, what's going on with respect to China and how they're ripping this country, what's going on with respect to OPEC and how the nations of OPEC are laughing at the stupidity of our country. Right. That's what I'm here to talk about. You know that's what I'm here to talk about. And I thought that your introduction was highly inappropriate, but that's okay because I've gotten to know you over the years.
Listen, Donald, first of all, I never said we weren't going to talk about the birther issue. We had a conversation earlier today. We didn't discuss at all what we were going to talk about.
I will tell you, it's not an issue that he likes talking about. So what he does is uses reverse psychology on people like you, so that you report like, oh, gee, he's thrilled with it. He does not like that issue because it's hitting very close to home. You know it, and he knows it.
Donald, you and I have known each other for a long time, and I don't understand why you're doubling down on this birther issue after the state of Hawaii formally says this is the legitimate birth certificate. He was born in Hawaii. Why are you going through all of this, Donald?
Well, a lot of people don't agree with that birth certificate.
But if the state of Hawaii authorizes it, if the state of Hawaii says this is official, he was born in Hawaii on this date, here it is, why do you deny that?
A lot of people do not think it was an authentic certificate.
How can you say that if this...
You won't report it, Wolf, but many people do not think it was authentic. His mother was not in the hospital. There were many other things that came out. And frankly, if you would report it accurately, I think you'd probably get better ratings than you're getting, which are pretty small.
Did you hear that? A lot of people, many people, it's all right there, calling the government stupid, repeating his long-since-debunked lie for the 100th time, claiming that many people believe the big lie, attacking any journalist who pushes back against his big lie, attacking the ratings of the news outfit that pushed back against his big lie. This machine, which has had different lies fed into it for different occasions, is the entire Trump shtick.
So to understand how the hell we got to where we are, go back to what was happening in 2008, what led to Romney's failed 2012 campaign, the GOP's so-called autopsy of Romney's failed 2012 campaign, and compare all of that with Trump's successful 2016 campaign that won him the undying loyalty of the GOP's bigoted base. The answer to how this country went from the implosion of the Bush administration, the election of Barack Obama in 2008, to the election of the king of the fucking birthers 8 years later, is right there for anyone to see.
It's all there, black and white, clear as crystal.
And not to blow our own horns too much, but if you've been paying attention to what liberal bloggers are writing about politics and the media during this period, none of this would have come as a complete surprise. A horrifying disappointment, probably, definitely, but not a complete surprise. It all comes back to the difference between Romney and Donald Trump. Romney came across as a cyborg assembled in a Republican establishment lab, trying desperately to straddle two factions of the GOP that fundamentally despised each other. Trump did the opposite. He embraced the base's rage, paranoia, bigotry completely. He absolved them of George Bush, and he turned their hatred of the Republican establishment into political rocket fuel.
Remember that the Republican establishment wanted it to be Jeb.
Yeah. And on the debate stage in South Carolina, Trump said, "Are you fucking kidding me? His brother lied us into the war. Wasn't your fault. You fell for it. We all fell for it. But he lied us into that war. And you want to make his brother president? Come on." And that won him the eternal loyalty of the base, who desperately wanted to be absolved.
He wanted
of the
a blank check out of that responsibility.
Fuck right? Yeah.
But to get From there to here, the Republican Party had to bulldoze the entire failed Bush administration down the memory hole, bye-bye, and then spend the next 8 years feeding lies, conspiracies, and openly racist red meat to a party base who were already brainwashed by Fox News and hate radio, spinning them up into a state of perpetual unhinged rage, which created the perfect feeding ground for a monster like Trump.
The news roundup will return on Thursday, maybe.
Feel free to write to both of us at proleftpodcast@gmail.com. I do want to thank everyone that's written us letters and sent us $5 in a blank envelope from Iowa on a regular basis with nothing in it to indicate anything. But it comes regularly enough that we appreciate you.
It comes from the heart, and we know
and
that.
It comes from the heart. And all of you who write to us for whatever reason and for whatever you send us, I want to take this time to say thank you very, very much. We love getting mail from you. Be aware that if you write to us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service, go Postal Unions, letter on the air unless you say otherwise. And again, thank you for supporting our show. Thank you for supporting the work we do. You can do so at patreon.com, on Venmo, via PayPal. Everything is there at proleftpod.com on how to support us. Thank you.
And if you can, please share our show on social media. We're doing real good in that area. People are sharing our show. We're hearing back from people going, this is great. I just discovered you. And I know how that feels to discover a writer or a podcaster or a program or something that speaks to you. And it was out there and you didn't know about it. And then you found out about it. And it makes you feel great. So do that for your friends. Share our show with them. And if you love this podcast, just get someone else to listen to it. And this week, look for me, your friendly Uncle Drift Glass, on the Bob Seska Show tomorrow, and the Bradcast with Brad Friedman, Desi Doyen, and the inimitable Digby on Thursday. And after I clean myself up, the Nicole Sandler Show also on Wednesday. So it's going to be a busy week for this kid. And I'll be back Thursday with my beautiful wife at the Professional Left Podcast. So I'm not answering phone calls for the rest of the week.
Hey, Drift Glass, how are the internet kiddies doing this week?
Well, the internet kiddies say if you want a bailout, how about bailing out them litter boxes?
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is produced and recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright DGBG Productions, ProLeftPod.com.